So some of you may have come in after the sit began, and just to reintroduce myself, I'm Kirsten, and this is the third of a four-week series entitled Keeping an Open Heart in a Suffering World. And in a way, it's been a real treat, well, in many ways, but was reflecting on the last couple of weeks, kind of exploring some of these issues in this Sangha around how it is that we live in a world and in where there is suffering, and how it is that we face that suffering with an open heart, how it is that we engage with that suffering, and really... for example, in a way where we can recognize the injustices and the violence in the world, and open to that in a way that perhaps makes a difference. And so the last couple of weeks, what's come up for me has been more of really exploring that, almost the tension that I find in Buddhist practice, where there's so much emphasis placed on things being just as they are. Really coming back to accepting this moment exactly as it is, it being the only moment that we have. And the profundity of that, and in coming back, you know, again and again to a seated meditation practice or to any kind of mindfulness practice, really the openness, the freedom in that, in not living in the past, not planning around the future, but really being here, being available for life as it is in this moment. So there's that gift in this Vipassana practice. And then what I'm inviting us to look at is what's really difficult in the world. And a lot of that that comes with that is this invitation to be engaged and to respond in a way that that responds to suffering with something that I call as a personal ethic, to make a difference, to be a force of good, of love in the world. So how are those compatible, right? I mean, things are exactly as they are, but are they not okay right now? Why is it that I, for one, feel moved to make a difference in some way? And sitting with all of you for the last couple weeks, this has really come up for me again in a new way. And so I have some thoughts about that I wanted to share. And then, like always, I really appreciate having some exercises to do together, a lot of what has been inspired by Joanna's work that reconnects. So, let's see. So the way that I have been approaching this kind of koan in the last week or so has been around a particular energy that I find in both, you know, practice, formal practice, as well as in the world, and it's the energy of control. So I identify that with wanting things to be different, wanting practice to be comfortable, wanting to see suffering be alleviated in a certain way, and there's an experience of tightness around that desire for control. And there's also a way that that control and desire for control keeps us separate, really needs that experience of a separate self in order to make sure that I am okay and I'm not threatened, to make sure that I'm getting what I want in the world, that needing to control things is coming from a place of separation. And then I've been considering what feels like a corollary to that, which I remember a teacher of mine, Tara Brach, describing this as empowered presence. And empowered presence being activity that really comes from an understanding of our true nature, coming from really finding, knowing in ourselves the depth of who we are. And I believe that that understanding is something that we're really cultivating in this Vipassana practice, of coming back to a sense of not being separated. And that empowered presence, the way I understand it and experience it, is that it's not a denial of what's going on. So it's not a denial of loss. It's not a denial of suffering. But it actually, in being in that presence, it really creates space for an appropriate response. And I think I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, but I've been thinking about the word responsibility. And I think of that empowered presence, that space, as giving, as creating space for responsibility, for a response to come based on the conditions of each moment. So that's how I'm really been sitting with this koan, really, of how it is, you know, that there's this Buddhist concept of non-attachment, of no self, and yet here there is also a world that really needs our service in certain ways. And I think that it comes back to this empowered presence from which we can be responsible. So I actually wanted to invite us for just a moment to feel into that sense of tightness, of wanting things to be a certain way. And if you'd like to just close your eyes for, you know, a few moments and just kind of tap into that sense of urgency or anxiety or fear around what it looks like to really be attached to the way that things are unfolding. And if it helps to have a particular example, you know, of something that troubles you in the world, to use that, but to come from a place of contraction around it and just to feel that for a moment. Maybe not so comfortable. And then the corollary of coming to a sense of what I'm describing, this empowered presence. And perhaps just to kind of put in the word empowered. You know, what does it feel like to be empowered? What does it feel like to live in an empowered way? And So just sit with that for a moment too. Does anyone have, it's not at all necessary, but does anyone have any reflections on that?
Could you say a little bit more about what you mean by empowered presence?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So what I mean by it is, to me, it feels like tapping into our own true nature. And what I mean by that is that there's when I think it comes back to this very simple practice of being here and coming back to this moment. But in this moment, in a moment without concept of who I am in the future, who I was in the past, what all of this experience means within a concept, I think that there's a real great freedom in being with who, what I am in a moment without all of the definitions of what I thought I would be or how I think things should be or could be. And that there's a lot of that sense of presence is the capacity is enormous for what that can be or can mean when it's free from any limitations that we put on it. Does that clarify?
How is that empowering?
Well, I think about it as empowering just because it is so free of any conceptual limits. So there's a potential for anything to come through, for any creative response, for absolutely any response. And it doesn't have to look a certain way, it doesn't have to have been planned in a certain fashion, because it's beyond that grasping or striving around controlling events in a certain way.
Is it because you're not attaching concept to it?
Mm-hmm.
It seems like it's making room for a different kind of wisdom to emerge that's very intuitive. It doesn't come from a thinking, analytical place.
Yeah.
It comes from something else.
Yeah.
And that's the creative upwelling.
Mm-hmm. I think about when I was in high school and I was I went through a period of being pretty misanthropic, and I was looking around at all of the suffering in the world, and acknowledging how much war and violence, and unnecessary war and violence, and injustice, and people starving to death, and nuclear weapons, and it just was overwhelming, and I remember for a while walking around, completely hopeless and despairing and angry. And there was a real urgency. I really wanted things to be different, but there was also this very fierce anger around things are, they're just not okay, and nobody's okay, and the world is a terrible, terrible place. Just a lot of rage, and so I'm not really even judging that. I think that maybe that can be a very fruitful energy at times. But to me, that feels like there was such a strong sense of what is right and what is wrong, and such a sense of separation, and such a desire for controlling things in a certain way. And I think about, though, as I began getting introduced and deepening this practice, and then working with Joanna Macy, and then also doing teaching environmental studies at the University of Oregon for a while, and I would have students come into my office and say, "How come I didn't know any of this? How do I even walk around in the world? You know, this is devastating, and I'm so upset." And what I started to do was actually hold groups where I would have students really experience those emotions as they were, and just open to those and embrace those, and notice them as, you know, what they are. They're this emotional response to what's happening. But in a way, you know, that's our Vipassana practice, is opening to whatever arises, of an emotion, a sensation, thoughts, and then noticing that they also pass, that they're impermanent, that they're not who we are. And I think my experience, and my experience even just brushing these students' lives in this very, like, kind of subversive mindfulness sort of way, really, really did create opportunity for a sense of empowerment, a sense of, okay, this anger, this and that is not who I truly am. The world is as it is, and from that, like, is there some wisdom here that directs me? That, you know, is there a way that that the heart speaks? And so that's what I'm. That's where I'm kind of coming from with this. Yeah, and it's an exploration for me. So I'm bringing it up to you as an exploration, and I so welcome these questions because it just helps me work with it in my own self. Yeah.
Just one comment I would have is, when we're talking about the sort of summoning the feeling of control, you know, what that seems to be attached to is a feeling of insecurity. Like, whatever you need to control, if you don't control it, then it's going to affect your well-being in some way. Like, that's the feeling that could summon. And instead having sort of not being attached to that, and approaching problems with a feeling of security, instead, it seems to me like you try to do the best that you can to tackle the problems as they are, but you don't place your feelings of well-being on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's actually a pretty good Japanese saying that says, "Desperate men only see straight roads."
Sorry, that's good.
That is good.
Desperate men only see straight roads.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really good. Thanks. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
First of all, sorry I missed the last couple of weeks, but I've gotten involved with the 99% movement at Karen and Simon, a couple of marches and so on. And I've been dealing with this very issue a lot, thinking about it. And I think what... the way I reconciled it was that there really doesn't have to be conflict. That in itself, realizing that in itself is empowering. You know, realizing it in a protest situation that, you know, we're not really on a different side as the police or the bankers, and, you know, you know, being in a situation, you know, in the middle of a march, having a friendly conversation with the manager of a bank, and, you know, sort of realizing that ultimately we're on the same side.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of a really neat experience realizing that, you know, there doesn't have to be, you know, overt anger, you know, and that the differences of opinion can be expressed in a non-confrontive, you know, way without, you know, without ultimate conflict.
Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting.
Yeah. Thanks. Mm. Yeah.
It kind of popped for me when you said the word empowered presence. And I've been sort of sitting with Anand Thubten's book, No Self, No Problem, and I watch the way I can tend to go into a kind of no self that's almost, there's a bit of nihilism to it, and like just kind of tending to like, oh, I'll just disappear in a certain way. So there was something really, I'm really grateful for that, just sort of like what, the kind of question of what presence that has a sense of empowerment. I mean, I don't know exactly in any given moment what that would be.
Yeah.
But I just noticed that it's a different flavor than a kind of almost dissociated no self, no problem kind of approach to Buddhism. And one of the things that reminds me of is the first time I ever heard the metta meditation. It was in a recording of Stephen Maline's. And I remember as a little kid just feeling the suffering of the world. I was probably 4 or 5 or something like that. I was feeling the suffering of my parents and my family. I remember lying in bed and feeling like there's some kind of like 4-year-old version of a bodhisattva vow that I won't be happy until everybody can be happy, which is like impossible. But, and I can remember feeling the heaviness of it. It was like this implosion of suffering and this caring about it and sense of responsibility. And the first time I ever heard the metta meditation, oh my God, it's like happiness could start here and then it could radiate out. And it was sort of like that, it was just that opposite of imploding. It was like, it's not exploding, but it's unfolding from itself for me. And I like that gesture you were doing, like it's coming up from and out, and it's okay to be happy, and it's okay to be present, and joy is all right, and that fullness is really where empowered presence comes from for me. And it's, so it's not being inundated or plowed under by the fact that there is suffering, but in a way like being present for the fact that there can be joy in the moment.
Yeah, you know what that brings up for me too. I have been thinking about the Brahmaviharas, the abodes of the heart. There's 4 Brahmaviharas, and one is metta, loving kindness. And I've been thinking about metta, and I've been thinking about equanimity, which is another upekkha. And because there's the near enemy, there's the near and the far enemies of all of the Brahmaviharas, and the near enemy of metta or loving kindness. Oh, actually, I'm sorry, karuna. So it would be compassion. Excuse me. But the near enemy of compassion is attachment, and so there's I think that really speaks to this quality that we're kind of getting at with this empowered presence of the ability to be open and compassionate in the world without attaching, without needing things to be different. And then upekkha, equanimity, the near enemy is indifference. And so again, you know, how it is that rather than have a sort of balanced engagement with life, to have a withdrawal from it, so that sort of nihilistic experience that you're describing. And I think that those are very, you know, the near enemies are very subtle, they're very, you know, close slippages from these really beautiful abodes of the heart. Anyone else going? Yeah.
I went through some of the same things you described, and with your students being frustrated with the world, and what you described being involved in demonstrations where there was a lot of conflict, and but it really felt wrong to be angry at other people and stuff. And eventually, I burned out.
Eventually, you burned out.
I just said, But I found another avenue in involvement with an environmental group that taught whitewater rafting. And eventually I became one of the teachers. And in terms of being in the moment and engaged with the person that I'm trying to teach and creative, but having to be aware of everything going on around you, because they're in learning mode, they can't tell that, for instance, the raft is about to hit that rock and it's a bad idea. So you just have to have this incredible sphere of awareness. You have to have this incredible empathy with the person that you're trying to teach, because they're in a stressful environment. Mm-hmm. And you're having to be incredibly creative to figure out how to engage them in a way that they can overcome their fears and learn how to get down the river. And for me, that was some of the most rewarding. I spent about 10 or 12 years doing that.
Wow.
And that was some of the most rewarding experiences I've ever had. And yet it still fulfilled for me that desire to see change in the world by passing on these teachings, by engaging people in the environmental practices of that group. Mm-hmm. And I had no knowledge of Buddhist philosophy at that time, but it seems to line up with much of what you were saying this evening. And it felt very empowering at the time to be engaged that way and almost kind of in tune with everything around me and this person next to me.
Thanks. Reminds me that a metaphor I was thinking about with this quality of empowered presence was surfing. That had occurred to me. And I'm not much of a surfer, but because I moved to Santa Cruz, I've been surfing a little bit. Mm-hmm. And, you really have to be kind of receptive and going with the water, right? There's not a way of kind of maneuvering the wave in a certain way so that you can get the ride you want.
I think all this points to really the second noble truth and the cause of suffering, that when we are feeling this great suffering, this great despair, that we need to look inside ourselves and see the cause of the suffering. And it really is in our own aversion and our own attachment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the response, the responsibility, is to take responsibility for our own mm-hmm. suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And search for its causes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I've thought a lot about the potential for creativity that's created by letting go, by getting the ego out of the way, and by opening. I always think about Einstein, that from what I understand, the theory of relativity just came to him. I mean, that's obviously he did a lot of studying and had the ground from which that could evolve, but it just came to him. And then after that, he did the hard work of figuring out all the proofs and all that to show that it was true. And I think about it, just something I'm dealing with now. I'm going to be giving a Dharma talk on Sunday, and I there are two ways that I could be going at it. One would be to study and pick a topic and really, you know, go at it, which would be the way I often do. And the other way is to just see what happens in the moment and be prepared to be, to just respond to the moment. But that's a little scary.
Uh-huh.
Because you could fall flat on your face, or it could be incredibly good. And so I think there is, I think it's a little scary to just, there's some fear, I think, around, for me, and I think for most people around, just letting that tendency to want to manage,
yeah,
and have certain outcomes occur,
yeah,
to let that go.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what you're speaking to is really, it's what we're practicing, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the
sure.
practice is,
yeah,
is letting go, is being with what
the true
you're.
Creativity, I think, comes,
yeah,
from that ability to,
yeah,
come from a place of emptiness, from,
yeah,
to come from a place where concepts aren't setting you on this course because this cause and this effect.
Right.
This is the way it goes.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So, our laboratory, where we get to practice that, is right here.
Yeah.
When we sit, it's safe. It's safe in the context of meditation to practice having no agenda and letting go and feeling the fear and feeling into it and seeing what happens over and over again. And I think that gives us courage, you know, doing it one tiny little experience at a time. And so that's, I think that's a big part of our practice.
Yeah.
Trying it out where it's safe, where you don't have to perform. You know.
Yeah.
There's no performance in meditation, although I think we bring our expectations to that too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and also, I mean, what you're describing is so much of, I feel like, that one, the one wing of the bird, right? The awareness of things as they are and trusting things as they are. And then the other wing would be the kindness and the love that's necessary in order to,
mm-hmm,
to do that practice.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's so not easy. Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. I had this whole agenda for tonight, and it's like 8:20. That's not going to happen. So
I was thinking of that. I was thinking of that, is that we've been practicing just what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
By just loosening up that agenda.
Yeah.
And I think it's been rich.
Good. Yeah.
And I'm reminded of one of the things from my whitewater guide training example. Again, one of the things that made it so special about that time was that I was in the community of people teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And if I was having a problem, or if someone else was having a problem, we could share experiences. If I was having a problem with a particular person, I would give them to somebody else the next day. You're good with this kind of problem. I'm not, you know, but just being in a very supportive environment, so that sense of sangha is, yeah, I think, important to being,
yeah,
able to practice.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I just want to speak a little bit more to the suffering in the world, because this is the topic of, in terms of really going into the despair. And I mean, like the work that Joanna does, where you just really dive into it, you know, and feel it and taste it and touch it, and your heart pierced,
mm-hmm,
and, you know, the screaming and the yelling and the howling,
mm-hmm,
and that for me brings creativity,
mm-hmm,
you know, when I really kind of just go to the bottom of it,
mm-hmm,
and can no longer go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that's where I found a lot of my empowerment,
mm-hmm,
by doing, you know, by just really being up front with it,
mm-hmm.
and not hiding it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think that we do ourselves a big disservice when we deny any elements of our experience.
Or even just kind of wanting to change it
without
first, really,
yeah,
doing that.
Right.
Like that's mm-hmm. the tendency, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm going to just
live. Yeah, and I mentioned actually the first week, you know, that Joanna Macy does have this kind of circle, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah,
it's
yeah.
coming from gratitude and then really honoring our pain, which is what you're describing, yeah. and then seeing with new eyes, which is kind of really what we're describing here, you know, from this place of empowered presence or selflessness, and then going forth. So then what does that look like manifest mm-hmm. in the world? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Are there any final words out there?
Yeah. I recently started going to 12-step meetings, and one of the really difficult aspects of that for me is the higher power sort of thing that you got from the gods. And it seems to me that what you're talking about may be that.
Oh, good. I'm glad that was a good thing. Good. Yeah, thanks. Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to go back to my schedule here, what I had planned, and just read a poem. I'm going to read one poem and end for the evening with dedicating the merit. But I'll start with the poem. So it's one of Rilke's sonnets. Quiet friend who has come so far, feel how your breathing makes more space around you. Let this darkness be a bell tower and you the bell. As you ring, what batters you becomes your strength. Move back and forth into the change. What is it like, such intensity of pain? If the drink is bitter, turn yourself to wine. In this uncontainable night, be the mystery at the crossroads of your senses, the meaning discovered there. And if the world has ceased to hear you, say to the silent earth, I flow. To the rushing water, speak, I am. Quiet friend who has come so far, feel how your breathing makes more space around you. Let this darkness be a bell tower, and you the bell. As you ring, what batters you becomes your strength. Move back and forth into the change. What is it like, such intensity of pain? If the drink is bitter, turn yourself to wine. In this uncontainable night, be the mystery at the crossroads of your senses, the meaning discovered there. And if the world has ceased to hear you, say to the silent earth, I flow. To the rushing water, speak, I am. So, I invite you to close your eyes and sit comfortably. Bring your attention into your heart. send yourself loving kindness. Recognize your intention to love fully. And then bringing that loving awareness out to all beings. May all beings everywhere be safe from inner and outer harm. May all beings be healthy and strong. May all beings live with ease, be safe. May all beings experience true peace. May this practice together benefit all beings.